150,000 quid a year to a former professional footballer while sacking journalists just to get a celebrity name in the headline somewhere once a week. That, to me, is pretty depraved. Because if you manage coaches and players to such an extent that they end up saying nothing, people will just go and find something else.
Hello, and thanks for downloading the latest Forward Pass podcast. My name is Graham Jenkins, and joining me today to look back on their career covering rugby union is Chris Hewitt. The former rugby union correspondent of the Independent newspaper, Chris has spent the best part of 40 years working in the industry and has earned many fans for his expert analysis and witty writing style. Chris had a front row seat for the dawn of the professional era, and more recently has been working on a book with ex-England fly half and the RFU's former director of elite rugby, Rob Andrew. He kindly agreed to share some memories and lessons from his journalism journey. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Now, if you're a fan of great writing and a fan of rugby union, then you are no doubt familiar with the work of Chris Hewitt. Until recently, the rugby union correspondent for the Independent newspaper, Chris had a front row seat for the dawn of professionalism and earned many fans and awards for his distinctive and entertaining reporting style. I'm delighted to say he's joined me to look back on his career and offer an insight into his approach to covering the sport. Hi, Chris, and thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you for the fanfare. I'm deeply moved, Graham. Thank you.
Okay, so let's take a trip down memory lane, Chris. Where did it all start for you? What was there a love of rugby, or was it a love of writing to begin with?
Writing, probably. If I'm honest, I didn't come from a rugby family growing up. It was a sports mad father who I can probably blame for ending up in the job I've done for the best part of 40 years in one form or another. But he was very much a football man and a cricket man. And it wasn't really until I reached senior school and started playing rugby and developed an interest, and then played much more seriously from my late teens on to best part of 30 when my body began to give out and I realised I wasn't going to get any better at this stuff, so I ought to go and do something else to save myself some embarrassment. So it was the writing side of things. We were a newspaper household, and my father was a good Labour trade union man and a dedicated reader of the Daily Mirror. And at that time, they had Peter Wilson, who's their great voice of sport, and he's been one of the great voices of sport in the whole history of newspaper journalism. I remember to this day reading his reports on the Muhammad Ali fights at the time. Henry Cooper, he was a great boxing man, and he made it exciting. And of course, in those days, you didn't see so much of this stuff on television. Live broadcasts were few and far between. And Peter Wilson brought it to life, and I suppose the germ of it was there.
And where were those first journalistic steps, so to speak, taken?
Well, back in the halcyon days of a structured profession, which was what journalism was at the time, you could find your way into it from school. I did my A-level. No one in my family had ever been to university. University wasn't remotely an option for me. So I was under some pressure, I suppose, to find myself some further education, which would result directly in a job. Now, I had two choices at the time. I was playing the drums with some fairly useless local groups and laboured under the illusion that I might turn professional. Or I could go, which was my father's choice for me, could go to the National Council for the Training of Journalists, 1 year course, which, if you got through the course, it was quite a tough course. It was difficult to get on the course, actually. It was quite a tough course. If you pulled through it, you had every chance of landing yourself full-time employment. In fact, I had three offers of a job at the end of my course. That's not to mark me out as any kind of journalistic genius. I think most people find themselves in that position because the entry into journalism was fairly tightly controlled. It was always the case that if you'd been to Oxbridge, you could probably find your way in without going on a course. But for normal human beings like myself, that was the way in. And I had a couple of weekly papers, one in Kent, one in Somerset, I remember. But the big one was the Bristol Evening Post, which is a big city newspaper. It took you right away from the weekly drudge of flower show results and funeral reports and the things that people on that very bottom rung of the journalistic ladder were forced to do. And it put you right in the thick of it. And it was a busy, big city newsroom. And that's where I started as a junior reporter. And it was a it was a phenomenally instructive career-forming experience.
What, was that home for you, Chris? Was that where you grew up in the West Country?
No, I was born in Bath, so Bristol, a few miles down the road, so I was still able to live at home.
Yeah.
It was just an exciting place to be. Maybe we'll talk a little later about where journalism is now, but where journalism was then was at the absolute heartbeat of a local community, be it a small town or a big city like Bristol. The most important man in the office when I started was not the editor at all. It was the municipal guy, the guy who covered local government, city councils, county councils. The amazing amount of scrutiny that a good municipal reporter was able to apply on in decision-making areas in big cities was remarkable, and that's been lost generally. Mm-hmm. I think a hell of a lot of council meetings and committee meetings now go unreported, and that's not good for our democracy, but that's me getting on my own. Mm-hmm.
So you obviously had a broad remit as a junior reporter. At what point did you specialise in sport?
Once I stopped trying to be Mike Teague, and I wasn't very good at being Mike Teague. And in fact, if I'd ever played against Mike Teague, there would only have been one Mike Teague, and it wouldn't have been me. Once I played for a big club in Bath. I was captain there for a little while. The club's claim to fame at the time was Jeremy Guscott's club. I once dropped a try-scoring pass from Jeremy Guscott, and I can't remember, because I blotted them out with the help of my therapist, the words that he threw at me when I did throw a perfect try-scoring pass on the floor. But I simply don't remember them being very sympathetic. So I was doing pretty much everything: political reporting, hard news reporting, sub-editing. I was chief sub-editor at the Bristol Evening Post for a while, which is a pretty demanding job. But I was always able to find a way, because of early deadlines on a Saturday, to get away in time to play. And I did that until I was about 30, and then found that there were some youngsters coming in who were three times as quick and knew 10 times as much, and were humiliating me on a weekly basis. So I thought, well, really ought to go and do something else.
So is that where you took on a larger sporting role? Was it something you sought, or something you were offered a role at the Bristol Post?
Well, I dabbled around it a little bit in rugby and cricket. There was a time when I joined the Bristol Evening Post when I wasn't playing rugby with any regularity, and would fill in around the rugby and cricket beat as needed, and really enjoyed that side of things. And then there was a fairly ferocious outbreak of office politics, spearheaded by a profoundly unpopular editor of the newspaper, which coincided with my dawning realisation that I wasn't going to play for England. So in the big reshuffle that happened, people sort of said to me, well, Hewitt, you seem to show some interest in and perhaps some aptitude for sports writing. We need somebody to take on the rugby and cricket correspondence job, and basically, you're it. So off I went, and I did that for 5 years or so on the Post. The first major sporting event I covered for the Bristol Evening Post was the 1991 World Cup, which England got to the final, and pretty much the last one was the 1995 World Cup, where England met Jonah Lomu'd, famously, in Cape Town, which is still the most remarkable thing I've ever seen on a sports field. So yes, it was an extension of all the journalistic background that I managed to build up in the preceding few years, and it was a thoroughly enjoyable beat to be on.
Was there anyone in particular at the Post who was a great influence on the how you did your job?
Oh, very much so. My first news editor, a man called Jeremy Bryan, who had in fact done the rugby correspondence job there briefly himself, but he was much more of a newsman. He somehow found his way to America to cover the John Kennedy election in 1960, mm-hmm. and to come back armed with a really highly developed sense of what journalism could do, how exciting it could be. If you threw yourself at a subject, if you got inside a subject, and you have the discipline and the patience and the research facility to bring a subject to life, and those were the things. to get instilled in me. He also knew Bristol backwards, his knowledge of the local scene, local politics, local culture was remarkable. And he was incredibly, incredibly inspirational to a young reporter. And the second person I would name was, I think, my third editor at the Bristol Evening Post, Brian Jones, who had been deputy editor of The Guardian, who our interests, our range of interests just met in glorious and fruitful union. Basically, he loved the arts as I do. He was a reader, big reader of literature and biography, as I am. And he was also very much in love with rugby union and cricket. In fact, he wrote a book about Bath rugby, which was quite well received at the time. And he went out of his way to allow you to be the best you could be, to use the current cliche that you hear an awful lot from rugby players and sportsmen of all descriptions. Mm-hmm. He gave you license to fulfil your own ambitions for your own profession. And that's quite a big thing, and I'm not sure what's happened to me.
And you said that it was in 5 years in that role. Was it then the move into the Nationals?
With a slight interregnum during the 95 World Cup. I'd grown up as a rugby correspondent sort of around the great Bath team, mm-hmm. As well as Bristol. Bristol were a big club, but very much in Bath's shadow at that time. We're talking about the Bath of John Horn and Richard Hill and Gareth Philcott, God bless him, mm-hmm. And your Tony Swiss and your Gus Scotts, Jonathan Webb. And these people were an outstanding side, obviously coached by Jack Rowell in his remarkably dictatorial fashion. Still very few people on the face of the earth can cut you in half quite as quickly with a single flick of the tongue as Jack. And that was terrific. And I'd formed a friendship really with Stuart Barnes, who I still see as the most influential club player I've ever seen in English rugby. And Stuart had just retired. He retired in 94, and was in South Africa for that World Cup in a journalistic capacity. And there was a thought that we might, we might push a monthly magazine, a rugby magazine, which did come to fruition. There were three or four of us who worked on it full time, did it for a year. He ran out of money very quickly. It was called First 15. We thought it was a pretty good product, but no one else knew because the brilliant distributors at the company we were working for couldn't actually find a way of getting it into the shops. So it was a well-kept secret, and in business, well-kept secrets aren't always the best approach. But it was a Monday to Friday job, and it allowed me, I suppose, to freelance for the first time under my own name. The Guardian were kind enough to give me quite a bit of work, and then the Independent on Sunday began to use me regularly. And when the rugby correspondence show on the Independent fell through, they asked me, basically said, well, if you apply, you have the job. And that coincided with the collapse of the magazine. So how's that for serendipity?
At this point, did you have your style? Did you know you had total confidence in your voice, so to speak, in terms of how you wrote?
That was developing pretty much in real time then. When I moved to magazine writing, I knew I would have to be writing on a bigger scale, instead of doing, hard-hitting, 10-paragraph, 30-words-paragraph news stories or match reports, or even if you were doing features on the Bristol Evening Post, I mean, you would rarely get up to 1,000 words. And suddenly, the magazine world was demanding something far, far more significant in terms of size and weight, 3,000-4,000 words. I remember doing one of the first really, really big interviews with Lawrence Dallaglio in terms of framing him as a possible England captain. In the same issue, we did an equally large piece with Clive Woodward, who was then largely unknown as a coach or not terribly well known, and we framed him as a possible England coach. Yeah. So that was my one and only Mystic Meg moment in my entire career. But that copy of the magazine looked pretty good. So yes, it was working out how to write on a much bigger canvas. You had the freedom to do it, so you needed some confidence in your own ability to write on that scale. One of the things that helped me was the company said, well, feel free to order yourself a couple of magazines on a monthly basis. and I began to subscribe to the New Yorker, which I still regard and indeed venerate as the greatest magazine in the world, with the greatest journalism in the world, written by the best writing journalists in the world. And while I would not pretend to ever to have written up to the standards of the New Yorker, it was certainly very, very instructive and inspirational in building a style.
You obviously joined sort of the rugby pack at the dawn of professionalism. Were you sort of granted a lot of space in terms of words in the paper? Was the paper as itself excited about the dawn of professionalism for rugby, or did you have to fight for space?
Well, there were two or three elements building into that. The Independent, quite unusually, I suppose, in Fleet Street was very interested in writers having an individual voice. In fact, that was the brief. The brilliant sports editor at The Independent when I joined, Paul Newman, who is now still writes about tennis, or certainly did when the newspaper still existed. I still think he's on the tennis beat. Tennis is a great sporting passion. I remember discussing the job with Paul, and I basically said, "Well, how do you want it done?" And he said, "Well, we want a distinctive voice. We'll give you the space. We'll basically give you the canvas. You choose your colours. Get painting." And it was exciting and scary at the same time, because you do wonder whether you're up to that kind of thing. But I suppose I was helped by the fact that rugby was very much in the news, because, as you say, professionalism and the political wars that followed the opening up of the game were in full swing. So there was a hell of a lot to write about. We were all finding our way, players, coaches, administrators, club owners and journalists. We were all in a big sort of wood where the tracks leading to the sunlit uplands were not obvious. And we were sort of finding our way through the thicket together, in a sense. And it was a really exciting time. And the other thing with The Independent, and just going back to why somebody's style develops in the way it does, The Independent wanted you to write long. You had to be able to write to 2,000 words, 2,500 words, 3,000, on the very odd occasion. And there were two reasons for that. One was, had a tiny staff, so someone had to fill the newspaper. Mm. And secondly, it just had a fidelity to the idea that enough people would be interested enough in the subjects you ran, if you did them well enough, to sit down and read a long article. And for a while, that was true. And all those things came together, and you end up writing in a particular style. I suppose my style was my own. It was drawn from various people. Martin Johnson, the wonderful cricket correspondent of The Independent at the time, as opposed to the former England second row, had established the principle that if you were able to crack a joke in print, then you should crack them. Well, Martin was one of the funniest sports writers there's ever been. So but the theory was that you read Martin put a joke and then read another newspaper to actually find out what had happened. I sort of thought that if I could combine the two, if I can crack a joke while actually telling people what the score was, I might be onto a winner. So those were the germs. Basically, it was a combination of personal experience and inspiration from other people and the state that rugby was in at the time.
Mm-hmm. That was obviously you spent over 20 years as part of the rugby pack travelling the globe reporting on the sport. Was that from my own experience, it's a great crowd of people to be a part of. Did you enjoy the routine of travelling and working with those people?
Yes, absolutely. I look back on that side of it incredibly fondly, I must say. It sort of reinforces your faith in humanity that people are meant to be competitors. And we were, in a sense. There is competition between newspapers, but of course, in reality, I was doing a different job to the guy on the Sun and the Mirror, who were doing a different job to the guys on the Mail. But yes, we're competitors. You know, one of the things you really hate to see is somebody else's exclusive, because you know that even in a fairly soft, relatively soft environment in these terms, The Independent was tough in many ways, but they were always very gentlemanly and dangerously civilised by Fleet Street standards. But if there was an exclusive flying around in someone else's newspaper, you would get the phone asking you in very polite ways why the hell we didn't know about this, to which you the answer because I didn't know about it. one of the most useless questions in journalism, why didn't you know about something that only one other person knew about, apparently? But given those obvious inbuilt strengths in the relationships built up by the rugby pack, mm-hmm. people got on incredibly well. They're almost without exception, they're a very generous, trusting, honest, really hardworking, spectacularly professional bunch of people. And I took great pride in being a part of it, I must say.
Maybe can we perhaps look on a few specifics in terms of matches or players or coaches that stick in the memory in terms of that provided good copy or provided good stories, shall we say, that didn't always make it to copy? Particular stories that stick in the memory or match reports that you're particularly proud of?
When it comes to match reporting, I suppose the pieces that you remember most or you take most pride in were the ones where you were under extreme deadline pressure. And there were times on The Independent when they want 1,200 words on the whistle in a night match. Latterly, when the Six Nations Committee, in their infinite wisdom, decided that it'd be a really good idea for England to play in Wales on a Friday night, conveniently forgetting the fact that even without an England Wales game in Cardiff, the queues on the M4 would stretch way back beyond the Severn Bridge. So they would put those games on in an attempt to get everyone into the ground who'd bought a ticket. They would put games on at 8 o'clock, 5 past 8, 10 past 8, mm. by the time it kicked off sometimes, and you were on a terrible deadline. I mean, the paper, The Independent, had early deadlines, and it was going to go at 10 o'clock. It was going to go at 10 o'clock that night. If there had been significant injury time, you would have been in trouble. So they wanted 1,200 words bang on the whistle. If you get that right, when you look at the paper the following morning and you read it with one eye shut, thinking, God, how many mistakes have I made in this because of the timing? you really tested, and that's where you derive some satisfaction if you get it correct.
And I imagine your sort of your rhythm or your sort of approach to each match report doesn't change whether it's, like I say, Bath, Gloucester, or a Rugby World Cup final.
You have to ask yourself, really, what are you trying to do? What is your point? What's the point of view? Is the question. Because it's a big game in this day and age. Everyone's watching it. Everyone, or listening to it, or following it on their phones. Everyone knows what's happened. You're not telling people what's happened. Not in my opinion, and not in the kind of journalism that The Independent was looking for. You're trying to identify why things have happened. You're trying to tell people something that they may not know, or else there's no point. Blow by blow account of a Six Nations match that's being watched by 8 million people on the BBC seems slightly pointless to me. So you're trying to lift the lid on things. You're trying to get in underneath where the real meat of the match is, and bring that to life. And you may do it with some jokes or some sort of fairly waspy comments, or you may do it slightly straighter. You don't make a joke about a bad injury, for example. It's all very well being whimsical and irreverent, but there's a time and a place for all of that stuff. But whatever the actual flavour and tone of your report is, the basic principle is the same. You're trying to lift the lid and get in underneath and tell people something that they don't know. Because when you're there and you're watching the whole game, see the whole field, if you know enough about rugby to identify why A, B and C is happening rather than B, E and F, that's different than watching on the television. You get it. You have to be able to smell the game.
Mm-hmm.
Even in a place like Twickenham, a complete barn like Twickenham with 80,000 people there, you can still hear the thuds of the tackles in the press box. Not quite as clearly as your kind of King's Home or the recreation ground.
Mm-hmm.
But you can still hear it, and you can smell it, and you're using at least four of your five senses to assess a game and get it down on paper, get it down to your satisfaction, telling people exactly what it is that's happened and why. And if you can do that successfully, then the sort of rhythm takes care of itself, really.
You've explained how your sort of writing career span the sort of amateur and the professional era. What sort of impact did professionalism have on the attitude of players and coaches in terms of their relationships with the media? And then obviously the knock-on effect, how does that affect how you did your job?
It certainly has had an impact, because it's become an industry, hasn't it? And in industry, certain types of job, certain types of role seem to expand to fill the room available. Look, there have always been coaches and players who didn't write the press, who either just genuinely didn't like them because they read criticisms of themselves in print or heard it on the airways and didn't like it very much, or that they were by nature rather suspicious of the press. And there were others who found it much easier to embrace the whole sort of media side of things. So that was the same in the amateur days. What's changed in the professional days is, players are now media managed. They're coached. I remember Brian Ashton, who's still the great visionary coach of his generation. He is England's Pierre Villepreux. He is, I suppose, England's Darwin James,
mm-hmm.
if that's not putting it slightly too high. But a brilliant, brilliant coach with his own philosophy, his own approach to the game. And he simply couldn't understand why anyone would be advising him how to answer the questions at a press conference. I mean, Brian's a bright bloke, and he basically took the attitude to say, well, I think I'm big enough and intelligent enough to answer questions in my own way. But he still had his briefing. So what Brian used to do before a press conference was get there early and have a chat with the reporters he knew, myself and most of the other number ones rugby number ones on the papers, tell them everything he wanted to get out there, answer all the questions that they asked in a completely relaxed and informal situation, then go away for his coaching, and then come back and say it all over again. So it was quite amusing. It's rather pointless, I think, the media management side of things, because if you manage coaches and players to such an extent that they end up saying nothing, people will just go and find something else. And as night follows day, the something else will be believe that the media has to sort of behave itself. Sometimes we want it all right. We want Eddie Jones to say something fantastically outrageous. Then we can plaster it all over the papers with a complete storm for a couple of days, and then really, really moan and whinge and beat our breasts about the fact that he doesn't come in the following week and say something equally as interesting. Mm-hmm. I think it's behoving upon us to play fair with our subjects. Yes, we want them to say interesting things, but if you're just going to make them look pretty stupid or make their life hell for a week once they've said an interesting thing, why would we be surprised if they don't come back and say another interesting thing the following week? Of course they won't.
Would it be fair to say that sort of there are less characters as such in the game because these players have known nothing but a gym and a training field and been bred as professional players since their teenage years, sort of thing?
Has, if not gone completely, it's certainly become minimised. I mean, back in the day, England, the England rugby team, to take the obvious example that most people will have some knowledge of, there were doctors and teachers and builders and what have you. I dare say there was a civil servant in there somewhere, although I can't remember one off the top of my head. And they were, it was a hobby, wasn't it? Hobby, but their working life was outside. So they had a whole background. They had a whole hinterland of work life that they could, even if not talking about that side of things specifically, they could bring to bear on their thoughts on rugby. Now it is clearly true that people are identified pretty early as potential Premiership football players. They go into academies. They don't play very much. They win an under-20 cap or two, and then they, if they're really good enough, they begin to be filtered into Premiership teams. So they don't have as much of a hinterland as previous players. But that's not to say they're uninteresting, because a lot of them are bright, articulate guys with some pretty strong ideas and colourful thoughts on the demands of professional rugby, and it's interesting to listen to them. It's interesting to see people grow over the years. I remember doing, on many occasions, just because The Independent allowed me to write about players that no one had ever heard of. That's another privilege that I'm not sure is available to everyone. So I was able to go to David Flatman when he was a kid. I was able to go to Tom Vandell. I was able to go to Dylan Hartley. Mm-hmm. As a very, very young player, who, because these people obviously had something different about them, and write 1,500 words, 1,800 words, explaining who they were, what made them tick, where they came from, where they wanted to go. And that was interesting. I had a lot of reaction from that. They were interesting. Yeah, you have to ask the right questions. You have to put them at their ease, of course, and they have to feel comfortable with you, and they have to trust you. A hell of a lot of this, the whole game is based on trust. And once you betray trust, which takes years to build, and you can lose in 30 seconds with one stupid question or one stupid headline in the newspaper. If you build that trust yet, the guys are still interesting, and I think there's, a lot to bring out of them and put before the public if you get it right.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting. I don't know whether this sort of relates to this, but the comments from George North recently about journalists, you'll write what you want anyway. Do you have any direct thoughts on that issue in terms of his reaction to the way he'd been treated or the way he felt he'd been treated by the media?
I wrote what I wanted for 20 years. You have to be able to back it up, don't you? You have to be able to justify it. I had very few major run-ins with players. And because of my style of writing, which did involve the old attempted a witty one-liner, some of them could, I would understand if they felt aggrieved that there was, some sort of bulky West Countryman sitting in a press box who'd never played professionally, taking the mickey. However, even in the jokes, there has to be a germ of, there has to be a point to the joke. There has to be a germ of truth in there somewhere, or at least a sustainable argument in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I mean, of the zillions of words I wrote about rugby for The Independent over 20 years, a fair proportion of them would have been uncomplimentary. Having said that, I didn't have too many arguments with players. Now, there are only two reasons for that. One is that no one read The Independent, and that's perfectly possible, of course. The papers now closed down through lack of readers. But the other possibility, knowing players as I do, and they read everything that's read about them, they will recognise that you might have had at least half a point. As far as someone like George is concerned, he's a very high-profile player, and he's a very high-profile player with a really, really serious, potentially career-ruining issue, i.e. concussion. And I think it's perfectly fair for people to say, to point out that that issue is there. That the last time we had the issue, it was spectacularly mishandled, which is now a matter of record because the inquiry found it to be so. And it's perfectly legitimate also for people to wonder if he's the same player now after all these concussions, even as a young man, after all these concussions, as he was on the Lions tour in 2013 in Australia when he was sensational.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that will hurt. There aren't many positives there for George, are there? And it will hurt him, and it will infuriate him, and it will make him feel quite bitter towards the media. That's entirely understandable. But I don't think it's a particularly good example of the media overplaying his hand or behaving badly. I think the media would not be doing its job if it wasn't highlighting those issues.
Mm-hmm. Now, the growth of social media, of course, allows players to take their story directly to supporters and fans or followers as such. Your thoughts on social media?
Possibly the last person on God's earth to ask about social media. I am a pterodactyl, basically. I've never really engaged. I have no problem per se. I think it's... it's there, isn't it? It's there. It's a fact of people's lives. We have a US president who appears to be governing the world's biggest and most powerful nation through his Twitter account, so it must be important. I have a problem with information, with unfiltered information, because how does anyone know if there's been no checks and balances at all, if you've gone straight from brain to public without anyone having a little read of things just to check that, you know, what you're saying is correct. And look, we're in an Orwellian world, aren't we now? Fake news,
mm-hmm.
alternative facts, post-truth. Let's just call that stuff what it is. I mean, they're just lies and fabrications. And I think the internet and social media has certainly played a role in the development of what is a rather concerning move away from old-style forms of information dissemination. But look, if players want to indulge in Twitter and have exchanges with supporters, then that's fine. There may well be a commercial interest in it for them, which would explain it. If I was a player, I wouldn't touch social media in that sense with a barge pole, because once you start putting your thoughts out there and you're allowing to be responded to and mangled by the great legions who are following you, then I sort of think there's only one winner, and you can find yourself in pretty difficult waters. And it's happened often, hasn't it, on Twitter especially. Mm-hmm. Players have said the wrong thing on the wrong subject to the wrong people, and there's been a row. And I think the trend will be that Twitter will become more and more anodyne, that it will be less controversial, less honest, probably less heartfelt. People still want their financial links through Twitter to continue for obvious reasons. But I think that people will become far more guarded, and God knows what the next social media revolution will bring us. If I knew that, then I'd be living in Silicon Valley with half of California as my back garden. So I don't know what is about to happen, but I think that Twitter ultimately will be replaced by something else, because I can only see it becoming less interesting and more anodyne.
Okay. It's switching from the future to the very much the present, how do you assess the state of the sport? Do you think the sport's in a healthy way at the moment?
If you wanted to measure it by in a chief executive's way or a bank manager's way, yeah, I mean, look, it's grown massively, hasn't it? And it's been an extraordinary ride. From the moment Lomu ran over England in 95, the sport has grown, I don't know, 100-fold in terms of its interest and its reach. It's generating pretty significant sums from broadcasting. Look, it's never going to be football. Is it in a good place? I still think, well, I've long felt, I felt right from the start, that the wages being paid to players weren't really supported by the business model. I still think that's the case. We're hearing that, I'm hearing that a couple of players who are moving from one, from a couple of clubs to one particular club, these must remain nameless because this is rumour at the moment. I always try not to peddle in it. But if those players who are moving at the end of the season are on the kinds of salaries, 350,000, 400,000, 450,000, we're talking about players who are still uncapped at the moment. If they're being paid that kind of money, then I do think that there's a bit of a reality check that's needed in the game. I think that's an issue. I think concussion and the way it's managed has become a massive issue in rugby. But the biggest problem that the game has is the relationship between the international game and everything else. I do feel there are too many internationals. I remember speaking to John Eales, probably the greatest single player I ever saw, the Australian second row and captain, won the World Cup in 1999, led Australia to a victory over the Lions when he really had no right to do so in 2001. And I saw him once at Twickenham, and we got on very well. He was a magnificent ambassador for the sport, as well as being a player of just the greatest talents. And I said, John, the Wallabies are here again. I see more of the Wallabies than I see of Gloucester. How can this be right? And he said, pretty much, well, in Australia, the Wallabies are all we have. And that's the truth of the matter, isn't it? That, you know, England and France and New Zealand and South Africa could be very, very, have very, very strong domestic markets through their own leagues. But Australia are not in that position. Neither is Scotland, neither are Ireland, really. Wales has given their league away. Italy has given its league away. So the game, there are certainly people in the game who are still trying to build something from the top down. And as any architect or engineer will tell you, in the end, you have to build from the bottom up.
As we're passing judgment, how about the state of the sports journalism in the UK at the moment? Do you like what you're reading?
Oh, look, there are a lot of terrific journalists out there. I think because of the online demands, some of people's best work is being diluted. But one very old school rugby journalist who was noted for his profound laziness once told me that there was only so much in the tank. Now there was always quite a bit in his tank because he never did very much. So, but I sort of knew what he meant. On the Independent, I would work 7 days a week, routinely work 7 days a week. I was certainly writing for six of them until latterly I was writing all 7 days. If someone's going to come along and say, well, it's when it's doing all of that, we'd like some online specific copy from you also, then you're going to say yes, because in the end you want to hang on to your job. You don't want to cut off your nose to spite your face. But you're going to end up writing too much, and the quality of it, and to me, the quality of what I did was the most important thing. You know, I wanted what I presented to the public, I wanted it to be well written. I didn't want mistakes in it. I wanted it to be well researched. I wanted it to be well argued. If I had a joke, I wanted to put it in the intro. I didn't want to put it out on Twitter. To me, what appeared in the newspaper was what I was offering, and everything else was a bit of a frippery. But that's a very old-fashioned view now. Mm. And the online demands are intense and quite high. And at the same time, staffing levels on newspapers are being reduced. So fewer and fewer journalists are being asked to do shift more and more words. And there will come a point, where you imagine, where something will have to give. And it may be the quality. But I don't think we're there yet. And I think that some of the guys who were serious about rugby, working for newspapers, who are serious about presenting rugby,
what do you think about what appears to be a sort of a growing reliance maybe on a celebrity byline, so to speak, of an ex-player or, you know, an ex-coach sort of thing in terms of delivering opinion rather than a journalist as such?
I'll be really guarded here, Greg, and say I despise it completely. I think it's a nonsense. I think it's a betrayal of... People will laugh if I ever call journalism a noble profession. But at its best, journalism has a nobility of spirit about it because it's drawn from a range of talents and instincts which actually are not given to everyone. I mean, not everyone can be a journalist. You have to train. You have to learn. I mean, a lot of that training may well be on the job. I'm not saying you have to, you know, have a double first in PPE from Oxford to be a journalist. Although a hell of a lot of double first in PPE from Oxford do end up in Fleetwood. You learn on the job, but you do have to learn. And to me, unless you're writing your own stuff, you are not entitled to call yourself a journalist. If you're being ghosted by someone else, it is simply inaccurate. And indeed, you're deluding yourself if you think that you're a journalist. You have to put your own words on your own screen and press the send button yourself. It may be rewritten in the office, but at least you have to contribute. As far as ghosted columns are concerned, I managed to avoid them largely. In my 20 years on the Indy, I did precisely no columns with players. I argued passionately against them because I couldn't see what players who were still directly involved in the game could conceivably say. They can't criticise. They can't tell the truth. They can't give you any secrets. They can't lift the lid on anything that's happened behind closed doors because the Rugby Football Union wanted copy approval before any of those, certainly in the England context, before any of those columns appeared. Now, if you're a self-respecting newspaper and you're prepared to be edited by the Rugby Football Union, or indeed any other sporting body, then I have to question why you're in the job. I did ghost columns with coaches. In fact, we had a pretty rich banner. I think I did five. Jack Rowell, Andy Robinson, Brian Ashton, all of whom have been head coaches of England. Eddie Jones during his relatively brief stay at Saracens. But he was able to comment on all sorts of things if it wasn't to do with Saracens. And knowing Eddie, of course, he did comment on all sorts of things. And Brian Smith, who'd been a very successful coach both at Bath, then moved on to London Irish and ended up in the England coaching squad. So they were a good bunch of people who were no longer directly involved and felt that they were able to comment. They were able to offer a critique. I didn't mind ghosting those guys. A, they weren't pretending to be journalists, and B, they had something of value to say. So I was proud to do that, and they were good columns. In fact, the Brian Ashton columns, I must say, which were much more about rugby philosophy, for want of a better word. My goodness, they were an absolute education and drew a tremendous reaction, certainly from within the game. They were brilliant. You know, people have asked to put them into a book and all sorts of business. So you know, that may well happen one day, but... So they were worth doing, but the notion of giving 150,000 quid a year to a former professional footballer while sacking journalists just to get a celebrity name in a headline somewhere once a week, that to me is pretty depraved.
No, I think I might know the answer to this next one because you've touched on it a little earlier in terms of the amount of international rugby that's played, but I'm going to put you on the World Rugby Executive Committee and the power to change one thing about the game. What would you take aim at?
I'm going to try to cheat slightly. I'll offer you two, but they're very different.
Okay.
I would hope that, and to a degree, I think World Rugby have upped their game in this respect already. God knows it took them long enough, but they are showing some support for the Pacific Island teams and showing a little bit more support for the developing Eastern European teams, actually, notably Georgia. It's an absolute scandal, isn't it, that no serious sort of top eight foundation union or top ten side ever goes to play in Tbilisi. Quite why Georgia should be, you've got more chance of Georgia being part of Gulliver's Travels than playing a game against the All Blacks in front of their own crowd. But goodness, if World Rugby's into the sort of missionary side of spreading the word, spreading the gospel of where the game is officially the national sport, they've made such massive strides. Why did it take the All Blacks, God knows how long, 50, 60, 70 years to roll out a better player test in the Pacific Islands? There should be tests in Suva, in Fiji. There should be tests in Samoa. There should be tests in Tonga with the biggest teams. And if the pitch isn't up to it, well, get a life. You know, all rugby players are played on mud. It rains in New Zealand. There are some uneven pitches in the far-flung corners of New Zealand or France or Ireland or wherever. So I would say definitely throw more money, properly channeled, but throw more money and give more opportunities and allow more training and development time for those nations that are going to be crucially important to rugby's development going forward. The other thing I would do, short of bringing back the old ruck in the game, where people, if they were led on the wrong side, would get a bit of a tap and be told to get out of the way, which was sort of what made the game possible to play for many years, I would end tactical substitutions. I would force people to get tired. One of the great things about rugby union in a team game was individually, the whole point was to subdue your direct opponent, was to establish some superiority over your opposite number. If you could do that, and if enough of you did it in your team, 99 times out of 100, you would win the game. Now, if you've outplayed your opposite number for 60 minutes, he'll get the shepherd's crook, off he goes, and some other stallion, fresh as a daisy, comes galloping on, and suddenly you've got to start doing it all over again while you yourself are tired. And that's hopeless. Rugby should be an extreme test of physical conditioning, of desire, of the ability to suffer. As soon as people start blowing a little bit there or make some mistakes, they're dragged to the touchline. And I think that's a slight betrayal of the game. So I would do away with tactical substitutions. It's easier said than done because people will cheat, of course, and pretend they have injuries. Quite how you get around that. We may need another hour or so to talk about it, but as a basic principle, I would do away with tactical substitutions.
That's very interesting, isn't it? And I've taken up far too much of your time, Chris, so I'm going to wrap things up with a chance to look ahead. And there's those of us, myself included, who miss your distinctive take on all things rugby union. What projects can we look forward to reading from you, or what's in the pipeline?
Well, there's a bit of freelance work here and there. To be honest, I was at the job, you know, full time journalism from my late teens, from the age of 19, for well nigh 40 years. So when the Independent sadly closed its pages for the last time. Which is a very sad moment, and I don't think that the newspaper, little though it was read towards the end, we never had any money, there was never much of a marketing budget behind it. When the paper finally closed its pages, I thought, well, I can take a bit of a break and just decide what I want to do and whether I still want to commit to any form of sports journalism regularly or just do something completely different, sort of dabble around in local politics or something. And all those things may well be on the stops. But I'm keen to write a couple of books. I have been talking to Rob Andrew, Fine England and Lions Outside Half, and a long time fighter in the trenches of rugby's politics, both as a Premiership director of rugby and with the Rugby Football Union. Just colluding with Rob on a book. He certainly has a story to tell. Hopefully, he'll want to tell it. With a high level of openness, but we get on very well, and you know he's approached me to do this. So hopefully we'll be getting a book out there in the autumn, which may lift the lid on a few things and channel a few thoughts and concentrate a few minds on both the past and the future of rugby. It's an interesting project, so I'm in the happy position of being able to pick and choose what interests me. That's something that does interest me. So I would like to think that if I hit my deadlines, as I've tried to do for 40 years, if I hit my deadlines, there'll be a book with Rob in the autumn, and we'll see what doors that opens.
Well, that certainly sounds like a fascinating project, Chris. Best of luck with that, and of course, many thanks for your time for this podcast.
And thanks for your interest, Graham.